This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, November 6th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We'll speak with Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and hear from CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Election week, we saw big turnout across the region, which mirrored the story nationally. And we're not going to get too deep into local results. I'm going to summarize them here at the start. If you want a deeper discussion on the local elections, check out our Wednesday broadcast of The Point with Mindy Todd and me, where we talk all about it with guests for a full hour. So here's a shorthand of what happened in contested races. In the 9th Congressional District, Bill Keating is going back to D.C. again to represent the region. In the Plymouth and Barnstable State Senate seat, Sue Moran won her first full term after serving out the remainder of the term she won in a special election last spring. For state representatives, 1st Barnstable District, Tim Whalen won re-election. In the 2nd Barnstable District, Kip Diggs unseated the incumbent, Will Crocker. In the 5th Barnstable District, Stephen Exeros claims the seat being vacated by Randy Hunt. And in the Barnstable County Commissioner's race, Sheila Lyons and Mark Forrest won the two open seats. Ron Beatty was running for re-election there and lost. That's the high-level bullets, but a lot of the story was about the way the election happened, on the ground, locally. We'll be talking with folks throughout the program checking in on that. Right now, we're joined by CAI's Jeanette Barnes, who was out covering the local election and the aftermath. Hiya, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, one of the big angles heading into this was the uptick in vote-by-mail and early voting because of the pandemic. But for all that, there was still plenty of energy on Election Day itself, plenty of people who chose to get out and vote in person. Tell us where you were Election Day and some of what you saw.
Sure. I was on the South Coast and in Bourne on Election Day. So I visited polling places in Bourne, Rochester, Fairhaven, and New Bedford. At that time of day, I didn't see any lines. It was really kind of not rush hour for the polling places at that point. But I did hear that it was very busy. The clerk said it was busy. In terms of people who were voting, who the people were voting for and what they had to say about the candidates themselves, it was a mix. Definitely, I would say among the Biden supporters, their first focus was casting an anti-Trump vote with the folks I spoke to. And Trump supporters, I heard a little bit of both, of what they like about President Trump and some of what they don't like about Biden and about Democrats in general. There was a Trump rally going on outside the polling place in Rochester, and that was planned to move by car to a few different polling places during the day. They had a lot of flags, and they were standing at the street waving to cars. It was really pretty typical, though, of what you might see at any polling place for a big race. So I think I mentioned in the coverage earlier, there were a few people with a sort of colorful clothing and flags and so forth, but it was pretty normal.
And then on Wednesday, day after Election Day here, there were a couple of rallies called Count Every Vote held on the Cape. You were there at one of these. These were officially nonpartisan events, is that right?
In theory, yes. I mean, the organizers asked people not to bring any signs for the candidates and to just focus on the issue of making sure that all the presidential ballots get counted. But the events were planned specifically to respond to any attempt by President Trump to undermine the election results. So, I mean, clearly there's a political bent there. I went to the one in Hyannis. There was another one in Falmouth. They were actually planned around the country in advance, and they were kind of standing ready to activate based on whatever the president might have done in response to the election. And some communities chose to activate them and some didn't at that point by Wednesday, depending on essentially whether they thought it was warranted by what the president had done overnight.
About how many people did you see there in Hyannis, and what was the energy like of people? They were people driving by. What was the scene like?
Yeah, they were. So they were at the Rotary there by the airport on the little green, and standing along the fence. They had some flags and banners and signs. Cars were honking, some cars, of course, not all, as they went by. There was a person there with a drum, and someone was singing, led them in a little bit of singing. So it was upbeat, chilly, though. I would say that there were about 60 people there at the height of it, and maybe after 2 hours or so, and maybe an hour and a half, the number started to go down a little bit. It was getting dark. But it was upbeat energy. A lot of people kind of chatting and talking about the election, and you know, looking forward to finding out the actual result.
And at this moment, I should say we are still looking forward to finding out the actual results from the election.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the pandemic now. We've seen an uptick recently in cases, which is what we're seeing statewide too. Tell us what we know about this uptick and where we are right now.
Well, Cape Cod officially does now have community spread of COVID, according to Senator Scheer. The reopening task force has been saying for many weeks that any new cases were isolated situations, but it appears that's no longer the case. The Cape has had new cases in the 20s or higher a few times in the last 2 weeks, and that's something that we haven't seen since May. That is kind of tracking a statewide trend, though, so it's not just a Cape problem. But, of course, everyone is watching that and asking people to be cautious as we head into the winter.
One of the things that Senator Julian Scheer brought up is the difficulty of access to testing around the region here. What has he said about this?
He said Cape Cod is a bit of a testing desert in the sense that we don't have any of the stop the spread sites that are in cities, where it's kind of no questions asked testing. Testing is available on the Cape, but he says most sites have at least one barrier that can make it difficult for people to get tested, things like the out-of-pocket cost or simply the wait time if you're someone who can't take much time out of work. He also says it's past time for Governor Baker to release some money. That's $550,000 from the supplemental budget bill that was supposed to go for Cape testing. So the county is planning to use that money to expand testing for people who are asymptomatic. Sean O'Brien from the county health department says he may even open testing sites run by the county, but the sort of the formal plan for that isn't done. And of course, the money isn't released. They don't necessarily, though, have the resources to test anyone who wants a test with no questions asked. So the criteria for who would be eligible for those sites is still being determined.
We should mention here that a new curfew starts today by order of the governor in response to the growing pandemic case numbers. Indoor recreational facilities and theaters and restaurants will either have to close their doors or finish service by 9:30 p.m., also on this pandemic, looking ahead to Thanksgiving, local officials are giving some early advice. Tell us what they're saying.
Right. Well, some are giving kind of the usual recommendations about trying to get together outside, keeping 6 feet apart, and so forth. There was a more blunt message on the Cape this week from Vera Harik, who is the deputy director of Barnstable County Human Services, and she's also very involved in tracking the Cape data about COVID. She said the message really should be very clear. Don't get together over a meal with anyone you don't live with. So that's really a little bit more direct than the way some other sources, including the state, I think, are saying it.
CAI's Jeanette Barnes joining us this morning. Jeanette, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Veterans Day comes next Wednesday. The local group Heroes in Transition offers support to veterans and their families. On Martha's Vineyard, the founders of the group and one veteran have made a renewed connection. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times has this story and more. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
Hey, George, this is kind of a circular story, so I'm not even sure what the best way to get into it is. Tell us about the group and this fella who you focus on in your article.
Yeah, so David Berube is a military veteran. He served for 21 years, and part of that time he served as a chaplain at Dover Air Force Base, and that, as listeners probably know, is where American troops who are killed are returned to their families. And so in 2009, he was there at that time, and there was a Mashpee family who lost their son. That's Eric Jones, was a Marine. He was killed in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. I actually was working for the Cape Cod Times at the time and wrote about the death of Eric, spoke to Cynthia and Kenneth Jones, his parents, and two of the most gracious people, I have to tell you, I've ever had the pleasure of interviewing, and under such tragic circumstances. And through the years, I did follow-up stories with them. They created Heroes in Transition in memory of Eric. The idea being, he was a helicopter pilot, and his mission was to make sure that troops on the ground had what they needed. And so the Jones family, they wanted to make sure that the troops coming home had what they needed, particularly the ones who had PTSD. And that's what David Berube suffers from, PTSD. He can't link it to a specific thing that happened to him, but he says it's a cumulative effect. And having an organization like Heroes in Transition has helped him tremendously with, they have equine therapy, they have couples retreats, and just talking about these issues. Now, what's interesting is during a conversation recently at one of these retreats, Berube and Jones figured out that Berube was actually there in Dover when Eric's body was returned. And so they now have that special connection and bond beyond the organization. So just really struck interviewing both of them. I spoke to them independently, and they both brought up this story. And so obviously it had to be a focal point of my story, telling the story of David and this organization. I think people will enjoy reading this and understanding that just some of the special connections that people make. And as you said, starting out, how this came full circle for them.
George, let me ask you about Election Day on the island, the presidential election in a pandemic. So how did it go?
One of the strangest elections I've ever been a part of, and I covered a lot of these, because the turnout was 74% up to 87% on the island in various towns. But there were hardly any people at the polls on Election Day. And that's because a tremendous number of people on the island either did voting early or mail-in ballots. And so Election Day itself was fairly quiet at the polls, and there were no issues on the island. There was a beefed-up police presence because of some of the concerns nationwide that there would be interference at the polls, but there was nothing like that. It went very smoothly that day. And of course, the outcome on the island, we're still trying to figure out who the president is going to be nationwide. But on the island, it was 4-1 in favor of Biden-Harris at the polls. And then we had a couple of other local races that people were interested in as well. One for the Martha's Vineyard Commission, and there were three people for two seats in Tisbury, and Trip Barnes, who's legendary on the island, easily won re-election. But Ben Robinson was able to oust an incumbent, Josh Goldstein, by about 70 votes, actually a little bit less than that. And he credits that to his position on climate change. He's been very active on the island, trying to raise awareness that the island needs to do something about climate change soon.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. A state public health inspector may have inadvertently brought COVID-19 into a nursing home in Chatham. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle has that story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, tell us what we know about what happened here.
Sure. Well, a team of inspectors from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, Division of Healthcare Facilities, Licensure and Certification, were at the Liberty Commons Nursing Home in North Chatham for a five-day visit recently. But on day four, one of the inspectors was pulled without explanation. And later, Liberty Commons CEO Bill Bogdanovich was told that the inspector had tested positive for COVID-19. And that was a surprise to everybody, as you can imagine. And that led to a round of testing of the nursing home's staff and residents. And two residents ended up testing positive. And this was they've been very careful at Liberty Commons. This was only the second time since the pandemic began that anyone there has tested positive. And there were two cases in April, both of whom have recovered. And what we found out when we investigated was that there's no COVID-19 testing program for state nursing home inspectors at this time. And Bogdanovich said that's something that nursing home operators have been requesting of the state. The State Department of Public Health issued a statement saying that inspectors are screened and have their temperatures taken each morning before they enter nursing homes. But in this case, it seems that this person had the coronavirus unbeknownst to anyone, and fortunately, it wasn't worse than it possibly could have been.
Bogdanovich calls it an unfortunate irony that this was how it appears that the coronavirus entered the nursing home.
Exactly. And, you know, they're not, everybody's being careful about linking this directly to the inspector. It is apparent, but nobody is specifically pointing fingers at this time. But it does seem to be a hole in the state program here that those inspectors are not tested before they do go into nursing homes.
Let me ask you about the election day where you were in Chatham and Harwich. How did it go?
Everything went pretty smoothly here in Chatham, Harwich, and Orleans. There were people outside the Chatham Community Center holding signs for both Biden and Trump, but there were no indication of any problems. The results in all three of these towns tracked pretty closely with the rest of the Cape. Turnout was pretty high. It was actually higher than the 2016 election, 83% in Chatham, 81% in Harwich, and 86 in Orleans, which is pretty big.
That's high, yep.
What I found kind of most interesting, Steve, is that, you know, Chatham for years was known as a very conservative community, but the past several national elections, going back even before 2016, Chatham has gone for the Democrats. And in this particular election this week, all of the contested races on the ballot went to Democrats in Chatham. So Chatham's really kind of turning into a little bit of a blue community, which a lot of people would be surprised at.
It is Tim Wood speaking to us from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Two people were airlifted to a mainland hospital after an early morning fire at a home on Nantucket. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror is on the line with us now. Hiya, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, your front page has a dramatic picture of this, the house just completely engulfed in flames. What do we know about the fire and the people in the house?
We know that neighbors reported hearing a loud explosion just before the fire tore through this one-and-a-half-story home on Surfside Road right near Nantucket Elementary School. There were four people in the house when the fire broke out. All managed to get out. One had to get out through an upper-floor window, but two of them suffered severe burns and were seriously injured. They were first taken to Nantucket Cottage Hospital by ambulance, and then within an hour or so airlifted to Boston Hospital for treatment. Their conditions currently are not known at the moment, but the fire was reported about 5:22 a.m. on Wednesday, and the crew of the first ambulance to get there and an off-duty emergency medical technician cared for the two victims while waiting the arrival of the second ambulance. Investigators from the state fire marshal's office and the state police and Nantucket officials were going through the what remained of the home on Wednesday and are considering all possibilities, including the possibility that an explosion caused the fire. Fire Chief Steve Murphy said he declined to elaborate further pending the results of the investigation. Like you said, the picture tells it all, really. The home was completely engulfed. It was a total loss, and the estimated replacement value is about $950,000.
One of the people who called this in reported hearing what she described as an explosion.
Hearing and feeling, yes. She called it in. She said she had just woke up, had gone downstairs when she felt and heard a loud explosion that shook her house. She didn't know if there had been a car accident in the area, if something had actually struck her home. And she went and checked on everyone in her home, walked outside, and when she walked back in and went up to her second floor is when she saw basically what was the fireball from the fire a couple hundred yards away.
You also have a story this week about commercial scallop season. It started up this week. Each year it seems to get harder for fishermen, and now this year they've got the pandemic to deal with. Tell us what's going on here.
Commercial scalloping was never an easy job. It was certainly a much more lucrative job, and the harvest was in many years quite larger than it has been in recent years, but you're absolutely right. There are only about 16 fishermen headed out on the first 2 days of the season this week. That's down from about 40 boats that went out last year. And a lot of it has to do with the pandemic. The people and the fishermen we're talking to say that both island and off-island restaurants, which typically sell bay scallops, either shut down for the season or shut down for good or having really limited capacity. The demand isn't there, and that's showing up in the price. Scallopers are bringing their catch to fish markets. Markets were charging about $17 to $22 a pound on Nantucket for the shuck scallop meat, which is down from $25 to $26 on opening day last year. And the scallopers themselves are only getting paid $12 a pound. Last year, they were getting paid $16 a pound. And it's obviously way too early to tell what the harvest is going to be like, but if you compare the last couple of years, about 7,000 bushels of scallops were harvested from Nantucket Harbor last year. That's significantly up from the record low 3,000 the year before. But it's a far cry from the over 10 to 15,000 that have been harvested over the last decade or so and the 100,000 bushels or so that fishermen used to be able to pull from Nantucket waters back in the 80s and even the 70s.
So fewer scallopers, fewer scallops, and yet the price is going down this year. It's not a recipe.
Not a good recipe.
For success.
Restaurants across the country, most Nantucket Bay scallops are exported to restaurants around the country as far away as L.A. and San Francisco, charge a pretty penny for Nantucket Bay scallops that are flown in, but they're just not able to sell as many because they're not able to seat as many tables, and some of them aren't even open right now.
Finally, let me ask you about the election. How did it play out on the island this week?
It played out very pro-Joe Biden and Kamala Harris this week. Nantucketers overwhelmingly backed Biden over Donald Trump for president, as about 76% of voters came out to cast their ballots. Biden does have a little bit of an island connection. He has been coming here when he hasn't been otherwise occupied with government affairs for more than 40 years, every Thanksgiving, so he is a familiar face on the island. He doesn't hole up in a vacation home. He is often out and about, seen on the streets. Lots of people have taken pictures with him. I think they feel a little bit of an affinity for him and with him, and that showed at the ballot box. Biden and Harris got 5,234 votes, and Trump and Mike Pence got 1,912 votes. That was quite a difference there in the turnout for Biden and Harris. Democratic candidates did well across the board. Nantucketers backed all the Democratic candidates. We only had one local race on the ballot in which Sarah Maxwell defeated Barbara Mendez for a seat and the register of probate seat that was vacated by Susan Beamish.
Hey, is there any early talk that if Biden were to squeak this out, that He could be showing up for Thanksgiving again this year as the president-elect, and what it could mean for the island?
There's certainly talk about that. I think the conventional wisdom says that might be a little too soon. He might not make it here for Thanksgiving this year, but there's also talk about Nantucket potentially becoming a summer White House, or certainly a summer Thanksgiving White House for the foreseeable future, if in fact he does win and takes over the presidency in January. But I think a lot of Islanders would like to see that. Some maybe not for various reasons. It's definitely been what a few people have been talking about as this election. The count drags on for another couple of days.
Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A new visitor center may be coming to Provincetown with a twist. It would be for a place you can't visit on the land. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner has the information for us. She joins us now. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Marianne, we're heading offshore here. Tell us about this possible visitor center. The planners of this are looking for public input, yeah?
That's right. So this is for the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, and you did hit it right, the nail on the head there, in terms of the fact that it's this enormous, I think it's 800 square miles of an underwater plateau that's a few miles north of Provincetown and about 25 miles east of Boston and basically between Provincetown and Gloucester. And it's really kind of this amazing place full of, whales and fishing and all of that. But it's really difficult, I think, for visitors to get kind of to wrap their minds around it. So the planners, and it's not really a new idea, but the federal government, also the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown and the town of Provincetown are planning this center to be located really right in downtown Provincetown. And I was looking back at older stories. It's not a new idea, as I mentioned. Back in 2016, the town had approved, I think it was $17,000 for a feasibility study. So they have the study. Now they're asking for people to take a survey. They held a meeting, I think it was last week, actually on site to get more feedback. So it's kind of slowly moving along.
Well, they're not proposing just a place to hand out pamphlets here. They're talking about a place where there could be classrooms and community space and more, possibly.
It's true. They've described it as like 9,000 square feet building. Across New England, there are lots of kiosks and kind of exhibits for Stellwagen Bank, but this would be actually a real live, brick and mortar visitor center for the sanctuary. But also it's because they're trying to kind of include the town and also the Center for Coastal Studies and also bring together kind of in an area that's a little bit, it's not exactly organized, that area that's right kind of between the entrances to the two piers, if you're familiar with that in Provincetown. But mm-hmm. It would bring together a lot of different little buildings, basically like public restrooms and some other kind of visitor type things into one area. Plus, as you said, there would also be potentially like classrooms or, like community meeting spaces. So.
Is it seen pretty uniformly as a positive, net positive for the town, or are there some people who have concerns about it going into that area that is kind of a congested little area in the middle of everything?
It is, but so far I'm not sure that kind of any kind of negative comments have really surfaced so far, because it seems like still is. It's in the planning phases, and the feasibility study is quite detailed, but there have been a few barriers in the past in terms of staffing and expense. And in fact, the funding for the whole thing is still to be found. So I would say I haven't, as far as I can tell, I haven't seen any negative comments so far.
Let me ask you about the election this week. How did it go in Provincetown? What was the feeling and energy like?
Well, it's funny. When I was listening to George talk about the vineyard, it was, maybe it was because it was right after lunch, but when I visited each of the polling places at about, it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, they were quite, it was not really busy. And each of the town, each one was, you know, kind of a steady trickle of people, not, and there weren't a lot of people actually in Provincetown and Truro. There wasn't even one person holding or waving signs out outside. But the word that the three town clerks talked about is, you know, the word steady. There was a steady pace. So, and they all ended up, I mean, particularly Provincetown, which is a hand where they actually hand count the ballots. They did that in the auditorium. They used, I think the town clerk said 32 volunteers to do the hand counting, and they got their count done by a little after midnight. Truro and Wellfleet also got the counting done prior to that. So, and it was predominantly, at least in terms of the presidential race, definitely a Biden-Harris majority.
That is Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. On the Point, we're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. For some people, voting in Tuesday's election was a first-in-a-lifetime event, but not because they just came of age. Jack Spillane from the Standard Times in New Bedford is on the line with this next story. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Steve.
Jack, this is a moving story. Your reporter spoke with newly naturalized citizens. Tell us about this.
Yes, New Bedford, of course, is a city of immigrants, has many immigrants, largely from Central America and South America. And our reporter, Karen Dunlop, went out and talked to a couple of them who voted for the first time. Raquel Borguinon, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, from Brazil, and Adelson Cabral from Cabo Verde. And the enthusiasm they had about voting and having their voices heard was quite inspiring.
Tell us a little bit about Mr. Cabral, who your reporter, it sounds like, may have followed him to the polls that day in order to sort of to report on what this experience was like with him.
Yes, she followed him to the polls, and he at first went to the wrong poll.
Or accompanied to him. I should say accompanied him to the polls, yes.
Yes, she arranged to meet him at the polls, and he at first went to the wrong station, and they pointed up that his polling station was up the street. And she talked to him and went in with him. He was particularly happy because he had some challenges along the way. He had come to the United States to study, and after his first child was born, he decided to stay. But he had a possession of marijuana incident in 2004, of course, when marijuana was not legal yet. And so any kind of impediment with the law can make it difficult to become a citizen. So he was able to work that out with immigration and was able to become a citizen. So his gratitude in voting was even greater.
And then you also spoke with Raquel Borguinon, it sounds like, and tell us about her path to voting this time.
Yes, well, Raquel came from Brazil, and she also has an inspiring story. She came for a better life, like many of the immigrants, for economic opportunity, and she said she was acutely aware that many people from her community don't have the right to vote, whether they haven't become citizens or they are in the country undocumented. And so she really took a lot of pride in voting. And her son has just been accepted to Harvard. So this is a first-generation person who arrived. And her son, in fact, was also born in Brazil. Victor Gonzalez is his name. And he graduated to the top of his class at New Bedford High School. I think he went to Dartmouth High School on an exchange program, and he is now set to go to Harvard, a first-generation immigrant.
Jack, tell us a little bit about the election on the South Coast. In the past, we've talked a couple of times about incidents between people on opposite sides of the political spectrum there. It seemed there were high tensions. How did it go?
It went well. It's interesting. There are a large blue-collar white communities, of course, in Greater New Bedford. And some of Acushnet, the town, one of the towns directly adjacent to New Bedford, voted for Donald Trump, as did Rochester, a more rural town nearby. The town of Westport, which is a combination of very affluent seaside community and more of a blue-collar white community inland, nearly voted for Trump. We've had quite a few demonstrations, street holding signs, rallies, both for Trump and Joe Biden. New Bedford, of course, voted for Joe Biden. It's a Democratic city, but there really is a large blue-collar white population that is very sympathetic to Donald Trump's views. The sheriff here, Tom Hodgson, is very active and was the state campaign manager for Trump. We had some incidents where a Republican Senate candidate got into a scuffle with some protesters. So it has been a interesting season. New Bedford and Fall River both voted in larger numbers for Trump than any other city urban community in Massachusetts.
Mm. But for all that, it seemed to go very smoothly.
It did. There were no incidents on Election Day. People were worried a little bit about that, but it really had calmed down by the time Election Day came. You read about people boarding up windows in downtown shops. That didn't happen here. Election Day came and went, and with quite a few people going to the polls on Election Day without incident.
That is Jack Spillane from the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
After a lengthy hunt, Martha's Vineyard has identified a temporary winter shelter for the homeless. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette has the story and joins us now. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, the search has been ongoing for a bit, but it now looks like the old Whaling Church in Edgartown will be the island's homeless shelter heading into the winter. Tell us about this.
Yes, so this was announced at a Martha's Vineyard Hospital press briefing earlier this week. The hospital's been really involved in trying to help find a space to house homeless individuals on the island this winter. And this is after Houses of Grace, which is the island's only winter shelter program. They were forced to shut down due to the pandemic, which has been an issue throughout the country, but was particularly an issue here. I mean, believe it or not, the island does have a significant population of individuals who don't have a permanent home. And so there was really a group of organizations working to find a space. And a lot of money had gone into finding it, almost $250,000. And it looks like the Whaling Church has been secured, which is exciting.
What are the logistics of that going to mean for the Whaling Church? Do you have a sense yet?
Well, the details are still preliminary. A lease hasn't yet been signed. But I think basically what it means, or at least what the hospital CEO, Denise Chapici, said was going to happen was it would be open 24 hours a day, hopefully. Also, one of the things that got shut down because of the pandemic was the island's only daytime warming center. So it'll sort of function as that during the daytime and then during the evening. It has space to house about 13 to 14 homeless individuals, which, if sort of the average number of people who show up to the shelters that did exist on the island last year were to show up, that would be enough generally in terms of spacing. And the Whaling Church itself, for those who haven't been inside or seen it, is this huge, beautiful Greek Revival building that has, probably about a 500-foot or 500-person seating area. And then below, there's a really large basement with an industrial kitchen. And I think what would likely happen is that homeless individuals would be – that's sort of where the shelter would occur, would be in the basement area of the facility.
This, as I said in the intro, this has been kind of a little journey to get to there because the previous program space has been shut down because of the pandemic. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. And, you know, there are a bunch of issues associated with it. The pandemic created complications for staffing. A lot of people who staff homeless shelters are generally higher risk for the virus. And, of course, space and sort of creating a space that was going to be safe for social distancing and that kind of thing. And so the church, you know, the island was relying on sort of this patchwork of churches that would rotate nights when they housed homeless individuals. But none of the dioceses were going to be, basically they couldn't allow it to happen for a variety of reasons. And so it's really been sort of a scramble for, you know, over 2 months. And someone who's been really involved is Karen Tuohy, and she's the director of Harbor Homes of Martha's Vineyard, which is the island's homelessness advocacy organization. And, you know, they have money to pay for hotel rooms for some individuals. They have, just opened a house to sort of house like the poorest members of the community on the island. But those are sort of different demographics than people who are looking for a homeless shelter or need a homeless shelter in the winter. And logistically, they hope to have it open. Normally the shelter, at least the winter shelters, are open from January through March, but they're looking to have it open earlier and potentially later just because of the pandemic and the economics of the whole situation in country right now.
Let me ask you a little bit about the election, Noah. You guys, the Vineyard Gazette has a beautiful photo layout of Election Day 2020. Tell us about your coverage a little bit and what the story was for you on the island.
Well, the story for us was, I think, similar to everywhere across the country. Tons of people voted early, more than ever had. There was huge turnout. I think 78% of the island voted. Joe Biden received votes at, I think, a 4-to-1 rate relative to Donald Trump. Covering it was fun, too. I mean, we had reporters, because there's 6 towns on the island, there's 6 polling stations, so we had reporters covering each town and, you know, just taking notes and sort of absorbing the scene about what was going on. And during the day, we were like, oh, we're getting all these great notes. I think we should sort of create a photo gallery and a notebook and try and just record the moment because it is a historic one. And that was sort of the feeling and energy on the island. Pretty much all throughout Tuesday. Yeah.
As delighting in the fact that in the middle of our rather high-tech times, you have some photos of the voting boxes, the ballot boxes on the island, which are decidedly unhigh-tech and yet are still in use.
Right. Yes, it's amazing. Chilmark and Aquinnah actually still count votes by hand, which in some ways is frustrating because results aren't available until 12:30 at night, which of course isn't even a problem compared to what we're seeing in the rest
yes.
of the country. But on the other hand, it's totally, in some sense, unimpeachable relative to the sort of election security issues that we're dealing with elsewhere as well. And those ballot boxes are awesome. They have a lot of history. I think both have seen close to at least over 20 presidential elections.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
CAI's Eve Zuckoff was on the Lower Cape on Election Day. She joins us now to tell us what she saw in that corner of the Cape and talk about some other stories, too. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, tell us about your experience Election Day. You were in Orleans and Chatham. What was your sense of what was happening?
Yeah, I would say it was slow but steady. In Chatham, that meant there was a line of about 30, 35 voters by 10:30 in the morning. But it was orderly. People were in and out in a matter of 15 minutes. And then in Orleans, it was much slower than that. But I talked to the assistant town clerk who said that, you know, about 65% of ballots were cast early. So they had 3 teams that were really busy, really hard at work processing all those early cast ballots. But overall, again, it was really orderly. Everyone was wearing face masks. They kept a distance. I think there really was a sense that the primaries were a great practice round for the big leagues this week.
It turns out, just in the way it worked out, you spoke with a number of Trump voters while you were out there. What did you hear?
Yeah, so I heard a lot of support for Trump's economic policies from these folks. I heard them say, you know, it was really important for them to come out today. Voting on Election Day was a tradition, and they wanted to do that to express their support for the president. A lot of them said they want to keep America great. In particular, they called out, you know, support for him as a non-traditional politician, someone who won't kind of speak out of both sides of his mouth to just get a vote, that he was very much himself. But I also heard some reluctance that was kind of interesting. People said they don't always like the way he, you know, puts his foot in his mouth or talks out of turn, but ultimately they felt he was a better candidate for, you know, a whole bunch of reasons. Among them was Biden's age. But as we get the results on CAI, we will be touching base with a number of the voters we met to see how they're feeling now. But only time will tell as we wait to get the results back from this election.
You are our environmental reporter. I want to ask you about a couple of environmental stories this week. You reported on how much plastic the U.S. is producing compared to other countries. Tell us about that report.
Yeah, so a group of Woods Hole researchers teamed up with a bunch of actually national researchers, and they found that the U.S. produced more plastic waste than any other country in the world in 2016. And there are also serious problems where that waste is ending up. So it's this, you know, twofold problem. But first of all, the United States generated more than 42 million metric tons of plastic waste in 2016. I think that's hard to even visualize. So I'm going to try to help in just a sec, help you visualize it. Again, that's more than any other country in the world. But it's not just because we have so many more people than other countries. In fact, that year we accounted in the U.S. for just 4% of the global population, but 17% of all plastic waste. And at the same time, of all the plastic waste we generated that year, about 5% was mismanaged. So it was tossed as litter or dumped illegally in the U.S. or improperly handled after being shipped to other countries, mostly in Asia, for recycling. And to imagine just how big that is, the 5% that was just completely mismanaged. If you stacked all that garbage up on the White House lawn, it would reach as high as the Empire State Building. So, you know, and then in terms of mismanagement, we ranked third in the world in terms of mismanaged plastic.
So that's a lot of mismanaged plastic. That's a lot of plastic waste. What are researchers recommending?
Yeah, they're recommending a couple things cautiously. At first, they're saying there really needs to be systemic change. In the U.S., we know that our plastic is being mismanaged in countries with not great management systems for plastic. So we need to invest in better infrastructure here at home to collect and recycle plastic waste. And then there's an individual change that they're calling for. You know, the researchers are saying that we need to buy less single-use plastic products. And we're actually already seeing a push for that on the Cape. There's at town meetings this fall, we're seeing articles come up to ban the sale of single-use plastic water bottles from stores, to a commercial ban. And that has passed at a bunch of town meetings across the Cape in Wellfleet, Brewster, Falmouth, Mashpee, Orleans, a whole number of other ones. And we're waiting to see how it's going to go in Sandwich and in Yarmouth. Those town meetings are coming up next.
That is CAI's Eve Zarkoff. Eve, thanks for checking in with us.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with CAI's Jeanette Barnes, and we heard from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We heard from Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, and Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and from CAI's Eve Zuckoff there. Big thanks to our Dan Tridle back at the studio, making the whole show come together seamlessly. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.